Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We return to an investigation of an article by Malcolm Light on the AMEG website detailing how we should drill the Arctic in order to save the Arctic. And we go back to a poster on democraticunderground.com, Muriel Volstrangler. Muriel says Malcolm Light cherry-picked the worst single measurement of methane release in 2010, a startling spike reported by the American agency NOAA. It was taken from the Arctic Svalbard base on the day of November 16, 2010. Light uses that spike for all his subsequent frightening calculations. But here is what New Zealand blogger, climate show radio host Gareth Renouden wrote in his Hot Topic blog about the graph Malcolm Light used. Quote, "The graph comes from NOAA's Earth System Research Lab's Global Monitoring Division's new data visualization webpage here. You'll see a CO2 graph first, but click on the menu to the left of the graph to get the methane version. The readings for the last year are preliminary and shown in brown. The last five data points are so far off the chart that they are almost certainly going to be rejected as being caused by local contamination. That's happened before. The green dots show when. And at the moment, other Arctic sites are not showing a similar rise. However, Svalbard is close to sea floor methane hydrate deposits that are known to be venting gas." End quote from Gareth Renouden at hottopic.co.nz. Muriel Volstranger tells us the data points showing the big methane spike have indeed been revised by NOAA, who always said such measurements were provisional. "I checked. The spike is gone. The steady rise over the decades is back. You can see it for yourself at the NOAA site." Therefore, most of the calculation in Malcolm Light's paper are not based on reality. They show what could happen, maybe, if there ever was a big release of methane in the Arctic, which continued at the new high level. But that hasn't happened at all. There's no doubt about this. Actual methane levels in the global atmosphere have not spiked beyond the gradual increase we've seen for decades. There is no emergency yet. Who is Malcolm Light, and what does he want? At AMEG, we find only this. Malcolm Light, specialist in earth sciences, blogger at globalwarminglight.blogspot.com. He claims a PhD from the University of London, but we are not told in what field. I checked that blog address, but Global Warming Light has been taken over by companies selling financial services. It's a dead end. An article at The Ecologist magazine describes Light as an inventor and retired professor. Not much information there. At a post at peakoil.com, Light says of himself, "Malcolm Light, retired Arctic oil, mineral, and climate researcher. Getting closer." I followed up on papers published by Malcolm Light, which he cites in his AMEG posting. It is from the place where Malcolm Light worked, the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas, Austin. He is a petroleum geologist who spent most of his career in Texas preparing information to assist extraction of fossil fuels. In his earlier days, at least, he was never a climate scientist or an Arctic expert. Now we understand the vision that Malcolm Light is advancing to solve the climate crisis, a solution which hardly anyone in the environment community knows about. Digging around on the net, we find Malcolm Light has two main answers for the methane emergency. Other scientists, like David Archer at the University of Chicago, remember, dispute there is any such emergency at this time. The first solution, Light calls Project Lucy. I found it at the Iowa City Climate Advocates site. In this paper, Malcolm Light gives himself a new description. Quote, "Malcolm Light, PhD, University of London, consultant with many years of experience in methane, diamonds, and numerous related topics." End quote. Here is Light's solution number one. Quote, "Project Lucy therefore aims to design, build, and test a microwave transmission system targeting low-altitude methane clouds with the aim of breaking the first C-H bond as soon as the methane erupts into the atmosphere from the Arctic Ocean. The transmitters can be mounted on submarines, planes, and after 2015, on boats and drilling rigs when the Arctic ice cap has melted." End quote. Light also calls for the use of HARP, the High Frequency Active Oral Research Program, super radio wave broadcasting facility in Alaska, to break up methane. He wants to use the multi-billion-dollar secret military facilities in both the United States and Russia to emit a very specific frequency. Not only will this break up methane into less harmful chemicals, Light claims, it will create a byproduct of nanodiamonds, tiny flecks of diamonds in the upper atmosphere, which would serve to reflect more sunlight away from Earth. Lucy in the sky with diamonds. I like the idea that radio will save the world. That matches my own hopes with Radio EcoShock. Malcolm Light's second way to save the world from the alleged Arctic methane emergency is far more dire. Characteristic of the answer seen by a petroleum geologist or big fossil fuel companies, his solution is to install a massive array of gas drilling rigs in the Arctic, trying to capture methane from the sea and land before it can rise up into the atmosphere. This second plot has the delightful name the Angels Project. I found this in a PowerPoint presentation by Light titled A Proposal for the Prevention of Arctic Methane. ANGELS is an acronym for Arctic Natural Gas Extraction, Liquefaction, and Sales. The subtitle reads, A Proposal for the Prevention of Arctic Methane-Induced Catastrophic Global Climate Change by Extraction of Methane from Beneath the Permafrost, Arctic Methane Hydrates, and Its Storage and Sale as a Subsidized Green Gas Energy Source. A green gas, indeed. Shell Oil, ExxonMobil, Statoil, and all the majors will be thrilled to hear we must start drilling for natural gas in the Arctic right away or go extinct. Light continues, quote, After 2015, when the Arctic Ocean becomes navigable, it will be possible to set up a whole series of drilling platforms adjacent to, but at least 1 kilometer away, from the high-volume methane eruption zones, and to directionally drill inclined wells down to intersect the free methane below the ceiling methane hydrate permafrost cap within the underlying fault network, end quote. He predicts huge methane plumes erupting from certain identifiable areas of the Arctic Sea, from troubled areas of the seabed. These should be capped instead by drilling rigs and the energy used in place of oil or coal. Quote, Separated methane is stored in LNG tankers for sale to customers as a subsidized green alternative to coal and oil for power generation and for air and ground transport. It will also be used, he says, for home heating and cooking and the manufacture of hydrogen, fertilizers, fabrics, glass, steel, plastics, paint, and other products, end quote. And here is how the world will be convinced to burn this Arctic methane, quote, Support should be sought from the United Nations, World Bank, national governments, and other interested parties for a subsidy, such as a tax rebate, of some 5% to 15% of the market price on Arctic permafrost methane and its derivatives to make it the most attractive LNG for sale compared to LNG from other sources. This will guarantee that all the Arctic gas recovered from the Arctic methane hydrate reservoirs and stockpiled will immediately be sold to consumers and converted into safer byproducts. This will also act as an incentive to oil companies to produce methane in large quantities from the Arctic methane hydrate reserves. In this way, the Arctic methane hydrate reservoirs will be continuously reduced in a safe, controlled way over the next 200 to 300 years, supplying an abundant green LNG energy source to humanity, end quote from Malcolm Light. So, we will run the world from the Arctic methane erupting from clathrates and permafrost melting. Global warming will force us to capture this massive source of greenhouse gases and convert our society to methane power. Forget about solar or wind power, tidal, or simple changes to drastically reduce our power use. We'll turn lemons into lemonade as the Arctic warms. We'll spray sulfates too, Light says, using aircraft to cool the Arctic, and hope those radio waves create some reflective nanodiamonds into the upper atmosphere to further deflect the sunlight. It's a total industrial solution to the woes of industrial civilization. Think about this for a moment or two. As I say, we are forced to extract and burn still more climate-wrecking fossil fuels or go extinct, according to Malcolm Light. But we have only a limited amount of carbon we can still burn and stay below 2 degrees, other scientists say. I doubt there's enough left in that budget even to build and install this fleet of Arctic drilling rigs. No such Arctic drilling has been tried. Shell Oil's attempt last year turned to disaster when they tried to withdraw their rig before winter. It crashed aground in Alaska. Beyond that, we haven't a clue whether the methane will really appear mainly along certain fault lines shown by Malcolm Light. None of that research has been done. Does anyone really believe we can capture meaningful amounts of methane from a geologic release occurring across the vast Arctic tundra and the coastlines tens of thousands of miles long? The whole world economy would have to be converted to drilling rigs to capture a tiny percent of the methane. It doesn't make sense. Adding it up, it's a huge and possibly dangerous fantasy with near-term human extinction absolutely nowhere in sight. The UK government responded to the Environment Audit Committee's report by saying they do not envisage an ice-free Arctic in the next few years or a collapse in the major ice sheets on Greenland anytime soon. The government wrote, quote, "Geoengineering techniques for the Arctic at present do not offer a credible long-term solution for tackling climate change. Further research is needed to understand how such techniques work and their wider impacts on climate systems. In the meantime, therefore, we remain unconvinced that using technical fixes is the right approach, and efforts should not be diverted from tackling the fundamental drivers of global climate change," end quote, from the British government, denied. There are all sorts of curiosities lurking around in the AMEG plan to save the Arctic and the world. They suggest the move away from burning dirty bunker fuel in ships is a mistake. Ships should burn the dirtiest, most sulfur-laden fuel we can find to add more sun-deflecting clouds. Commercial aircraft, they suggest, should get fuel additives that create chemtrails to ward off the sun. Unbelievably, they use the word chemtrails, thus setting off another whole internet hive of paranoia. In fact, I think a case can be made that Malcolm Light's paper does two things. It creates a story to bring the public, and maybe even environmentalists, on board for massive gas drilling in the Arctic. That's something big oil and gas companies want very badly. But it also stirs up noise level around climate change, which may be just as important to the major energy companies. As University of Chicago climate scientist David Archer told us in a Radio EcoShock interview, once the public becomes over-concerned about methane coming from some faraway Arctic place, we can forget about our own roles in burning carbon every day in our cars, homes, factories, and power plants. It's carbon dioxide that really counts in the long run. Carbon dioxide, not methane, will determine the heat of the world for the next 100,000 years, for millennia after the short-lived methane has broken down. Let's hear a few words from David Archer on Radio EcoShock. And again, some scientists and journalists who interview them are worried about methane from the Arctic could cause a runaway greenhouse effect. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, a runaway greenhouse effect involving methane, to me, what those words would mean is that you get some warming from some methane, which then causes more methane to come out, which gives you more warming, so a positive feedback in that sort of a cycle. But because methane breaks down so quickly, it's very hard to get as much radiative forcing, as much climate oomph out of methane as we are already getting from releasing fossil fuel CO2. So the response of climate to the methane is fairly muted unless it was just a huge release. And then you also would need the methane melting to respond very quickly to changes in the climate in order to have, you know, a feedback. And, you know, yet you look around at how methane comes out and all of those sources are slower than the lifetime of methane in the atmosphere. They don't respond instantaneously or within a year or two or something like that. They respond over centuries. And so I don't see the potential for a runaway greenhouse effect involving methane. But I do see the possibility that methane in ocean hydrates and carbon that's frozen into permafrost soils could eventually release carbon to the atmosphere that would add to the cumulative effect from all the CO2 that we've been releasing. So the methane wouldn't have much effect on climate in the next, you know, decades, but hundreds of years from now, the carbon from methane and from permafrost soils could be sort of like matching funds or something, that we put in so much carbon from fossil fuels and then the Earth throws in, you know, an amount that sort of matches what we do or something like that. So that would affect not the peak of the warming, but rather the long tail, which with CO2, as we talked about last time, 2 years ago, affects the climate for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years into the future.
Well, the most catastrophic proposal that I've heard comes from Shakova, who says that there are 50 gigatons of methane gas as bubbles underneath the sediments on the Arctic shelf, the Siberian shelf, which could all come out all at once. And I don't know if I believe that the sort of slow warming that is happening there could trigger all that to come out all at once. You'd need some sort of a trigger, like a, I don't know, some huge earthquake or something. But if it did come out all at once, there's a interactive model that I published on my webpage that you can play with and see what happens. If you put in 50 gigatons of methane all coming out in a year, you can compare the climate forcing, the radiative forcing, the energy imbalance caused by that methane. You can compare that against the radiative forcing from fossil fuel CO2. And what you'd find is that the forcing from the methane after a big burp like that would be much bigger than the forcing is today from fossil fuel CO2. But it would go away in a couple of decades. And by the end of the century, the forcing from fossil fuel CO2 will be higher even than the methane spike was at its worst. So it almost seems to me like it would be a chance for humanity to sort of try it before we buy it for keeps with CO2. Might not even be such a bad thing at that.
So there you have it. Maybe a good burst of methane and a climate shock is what we need to bring humanity to our senses, to make us finally get out of denial and act. It's a horrible thought, but nothing else has worked so far. That was climate scientist David Archer, author of the book The Long Thaw and an editor at realclimate.org. We talked on the Radio EcoShock show February 15, 2012, as part of my survey of three scientists, including AMEG's Peter Wadhams. Find links to all of that in my blog at ecoshock.info. Perhaps in the next few decades, we will see a significant burst of methane from the Arctic. It's something that should be monitored much more. We should spend $1 billion on research to determine the real level of threat from the frozen methane in those shallow seabeds and from melting permafrost on land. I've done several Radio EcoShock shows about all of this and will continue to do so. I think AMEG has done some good work. We've had great interviews from ice expert Dr. Peter Wadhams from Cambridge and Paul Beckham from the University of Ottawa. Paul taught us all about the jet stream, the latest science. I hope to have him back as a guest. But I think the article by Malcolm Light is flawed. It may be based on faulty data and unproven assumptions. At this point, it's nothing more than an interesting idea in the realm of science fiction. We may very well experience a methane emergency in the Arctic. It's possible without the work of AMEG, we might not be watching as we should. Let the group carry on. But without the histrionics about near-term extinction of humans and reassessing their roles, assisting big fossil fuel companies, whether intended or not. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. I can't do a show on human extinction without saying that other very serious scientists, public policy wonks, and artists are still deeply concerned about it. As we learn more about biology, it's apparent that all species have gone extinct sooner or later. You may recall my interview with Dr. Peter Ward about the Medea hypothesis, that all forms of life are ultimately self-destructive. Find that on our website or with a Google search. In last week's program, I considered one argument for our survival, that some humans will continue to live directly from nature, even if our complex world falls completely. We heard from National Geographic author Scott Wallace and his book The Unconquered. If you missed that, download it from our website, ecoshock.org. In a future Radio EcoShock show, we'll hear other ways of facing ultimate threats to our humanity from the author of a new book titled Sustainability and Well-Being. As I read through my review copy, I was startled to find author Asoka Bandaraji says some humans are already going extinct. In fact, the Aboriginal people we were counting on may be the first to disappear. Here's a reading from that new book, recorded for Radio EcoShock by Asoka.
Extinction is not a phenomenon restricted to non-human species. Some scientists state that as a result of human dominance over the Earth, we have entered a new Anthropocene era, that is the current geological period where human activities are shaping the global environment. It could well be speculated that our very dominance is now moving us into a post-Anthropocene age of human demise. Given the intimate connection of their livelihoods to their ecosystems, indigenous peoples worldwide are most vulnerable to climate change, destruction of biodiversity, and chemical pollution. During the course of European colonization, the world's tribal population was reduced anywhere from 30 to 50 million between 1780 and 1930 due to conquest, the spread of new diseases by the Europeans, and sometimes outright extermination. In 1500, there were an estimated 6 to 9 million indigenous people living in the tropical rainforests of Brazil. In 1992, less than 200,000 remained. The few last remaining indigenous tribes are being fast extinguished across the world. A cautionary example is the Boa, one of the 10 great tribes of the Andaman Islands east of India's mainland. In February 2010, with the death of its last remaining member, the Boa and their 65,000-year-old language, which is traced to pre-Neolithic times and the first human settlement of the region by African migrants, disappeared forever. Like the Boa, who faced habitat destruction, poverty, and disease, all other Andaman tribes, especially the Jarawa, inundated by mass tourism, are also expected to disappear soon, along with their languages and cultures. UNESCO has reported that during the past 300 years, there has been a dramatic increase in the extinction of languages, and that 3,000 or more languages still spoken in the world are seriously endangered. A research study from the International Diabetes Institute at Monash University in Australia also warns that if the diabetes epidemic attributed to changes in diet and lifestyle is not halted, many indigenous people, including Aborigines in Australia, the Maori in New Zealand, Pacific Islanders, and Native Americans, could become extinct by the end of the century. Indigenous people are not the only ones victimized and made dispensable in the process of economic integration and cultural homogenization of the world. Many other groups are experiencing ecological and economic collapse and loss of livelihood.
That was Asoka Bandaraji reading from her book Sustainability and Well-Being, published by Palgrave. Perhaps we can only go extinct if we accept that as our fate and refuse to change our ways. Our last clip comes from 2005 by author and longtime Sacramento journalist John D. Cox. Cox was speaking at the launch of his book Climate Crash, Discovering Rapid Climate Change and What It Means to Our Future. He brought up one of the few cases of extinction in our recent history, namely the Viking settlement on the coast of Greenland. They were hit hard by climate change as the times became colder.
I think there are all kinds of institutional constraints against adaptation. Modern societies have property right issues and all kinds of ownership issues and real estate issues and other regulatory issues that in infrastructures that depend on storm tracks arriving at a certain place and so the water supply is stable. There's all kinds of things that invest us in stability. So I think if there's going to be instability, if there's going to be some kind of rapid change, almost to the point of a public emergency situation, where growing areas or agricultural areas are no longer going to get sufficient water, etc., you have to be able to sort of think outside the box and do things, be prepared to do things on a different level than you might otherwise do. I think we should do everything we can to avoid such a thing happening. And if it still happens, we're going to have to be prepared to do things that sort of unthinkable things about changing certain habits. There's an interesting corollary to some of this in a way, and that is in the 10th century, the The first European settlement in the West was created by the Norse in Greenland, and it was an entirely successful colony for the better part of 400 years. And then it died out, and there's a, you know, it's an interesting story about how climate changed up there abruptly, and suddenly it just, you know, as the old, you know, the anonymous author said, you know, it got cold and they died. Well, you know, they've looked into that with the ice core work and the isotope work that they've been able to do with some really detail now, and they've also, you know, this interdisciplinary approaches have looked at this question, you know, more thoroughly. You know, the Greenland, Norse Greenland colony, this European colony, failed at the very time that the native Inuit was thriving in that condition. You know, why did the Norse fail and the Inuit thrive? It's because they didn't adapt. You know, they were unable to change their culture to adopt, you know, successful technologies that the Inuit employed for, you know, for hunting seal. You know, they had these skin boats that were able to just pick up over the ice and slide along and put them back down in the water. You know, it was just this sense of this culture identity that permitted, that allowed the Norse to choose extinction, in a sense, over the adoption of the culture of the pagan Inuit that they despised. You know, there is a case of adaptation failure. You know, we look at it now and say, well, those fools, you know, it was right there. All they had to do was you know, adopt the, you know, the hinged harpoon and that kind of thing, like the Inuit had. All they had to do was change their boats, that kind of thing. Well, you know, we'll see. I mean, some of the resistance that we see at the political level, this is kind of the song that we're singing to ourselves about whether we're adapting or not. You know, I mean, we can all decide how successfully that's going, but in a way, it's, you know, it's like the old Norse. You know, they decided that they weren't going to change by God. They were going to keep their ties to the church, and they were going to, you know, continue the everything European that they could think of. And, you know, there you are.
You can find that video on C-SPAN or the link at ecoshock.info. Will we choose extinction, even when more natural ways of survival are known, are there right before our faces? Are we too inflexible to survive? Too wedded to the many fossil fuel-powered slaves we all enjoy, from cars to dishwashers and vacation flights? As John Michael Greer suggested, we may bump down some hard stairs for a few hundred years. I expect plenty of mass die-offs, a decrease in human population, and forced climate migrations. But in 2050, I think my grandson will be alive, and despite all, he'll be glad to be alive. That is the way we are. Please support Radio EcoShock if you can at our website at ecoshock.org. I ask you to educate yourself to the challenge by listening to our scientists and authors in past shows. You can get them as free MP3 files on our site. Support your local nonprofit radio station, please, so we can stay on the air. I'm Alex Smith. Don't give up to near-term extinction thinking. Use our wit, love, and persistence to change the paradigm. And don't be afraid to have fun while you're doing it.
So if you want your kids to survive and not drown when the oceans rise, you'll be like that one apocalypse film we watched last night. Oh wait, they're all the same. Everyone dies. So if you want your kids to survive, burn up when the temperatures rise. Ashes to ashes, we all fall down. Unless we take the steps to turn it around, you've got to think.